I'd like to welcome you tonight to A Feminist Perspective. I am Walter Smith, Associate Dean of Women here at the University of Kansas, and I'm substituting for Dean Taylor, who is out of town. A Feminist Perspective is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, located in the Dean of Women's Office, 222 Strong Hall. The goal of this series of programs is to provide a forum for women to speak publicly on issues of concern to them. However, this evening, the microphone has been turned over to myself and four other men who will discuss the male mystique. Tonight, we hope to discuss several topics of interest. What does it mean to be a male? How do male roles interact with the goals of women of the women's movement? Should male roles be redefined? What are the reactions of men to the new role definitions that are somewhat being imposed on us and some of which are our own choosing? How can men and women best grow together to understand their new roles? I'd like to remind you that we maintain an open line during our show, or during the latter part of the show, so that you can call in to ask questions of our panelists or comment on the topic of the show. The number is 864-4530 if you wish to call. Tonight we are pleased to have with us four men who represent various aspects of our campus. First of all, Dennis Daly, who is a professor from the School of Social Welfare. Could you tell us a little about yourself, Dennis?
Well, other than the fact that I carry a full-time teaching load in the School of Social Welfare, I guess I'm here and involved in this program because I'm concerned about the issue of my own growth as a human being and how that relates to the struggle for liberation, be it male or female.
The second panelist is Bill Robinson, who represents, among other jobs that he's involved with, the Dean of Men's Office.
Among others. I think my presence tonight is perhaps due more to the fact that I come in contact on a daily basis with a good number of undergraduate students at the university through my contact with the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences and Nunnemaker College. And I feel as though I've had some experience with these people, these undergraduate students, that suggest to me that the role indeed is changing for men and for women, and that the impact of the changes are things that can be seen very vividly in course planning, major selections, vocational plans, and some of the kinds of things that I've experienced there will be things that I'll hope to be able to touch on later this evening.
Thank you. Third panel member is Alex Thomas, who's a student here at KU.
I'm president of the Residence Hall Association, and in my capacity as president, I deal with the residents, male and female, of the system, and in this capacity I come in contact with the Dean of Men and Dean of Women's Office, and I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm on the panel.
Certainly we know Alex from many good deeds that he does, a very good worker. Finally, Dick Riemann.
I'm the swimming coach at the University of Kansas and also share a 50% teaching load teaching some of the aquatic courses, namely in our water safety program. I think there's been a tremendous new interest in women's sports, women athletics, in addition to, of course, trying to uphold a varsity program and an intercollegiate athletic program of some prominence here at the university. And I think that to some degree there's been a struggle for some recognition that really it should come a little more naturally than it has to this point.
Thank you. Tonight we have a topic, the male mystique, which has a lot of different meanings to a lot of different people. It could mean almost anything to anybody listening to the show. We found out as we talked about the topic before the show that it meant many different things to us, and thought that maybe we could share some of these ideas tonight about just what does a male mystique mean and how do we react to that. Bill, can you give some reactions to that idea?
Yeah, my immediate reaction is that the male mystique is a non sequitur, as a label. Frankly, I don't feel any more mysterious as a male than I assume that women feel as females. I think that in terms of its application, though, since admittedly it's an expression or a term that we confront and live with rather routinely, I think the male mystique is something that has grown, at least in the way that I hear men using the term, in reaction to the women's rights movement or the equal rights movement. Perhaps it's come about for men as kind of a defense mechanism to what some men are prone to call women's lib. I guess I have a tendency to stay away or to avoid terminology like that, simply because I'm not sure that it means the same thing to me as it would to other people who might use it or hear me use it. I'd frankly prefer to talk in terms of human liberation, basic human equality, and leave rather alone concepts as diverse or ambiguous in my mind as female mystique or male mystique. I think the term itself is the mystique.
Or mistake.
Or mistake. Very good, yeah.
Dennis?
Well, I think to some extent the what Bill says is correct. I think in many ways the concept exists primarily because it plays into the polarity that is so often, I think, generated around the issue of women's liberation, and it's simply the label for the other side of the war. And I couldn't agree more with what Bill says with regard to the issue of human realization that and human liberation, that's really where it's at. And yet, as we were discussing earlier, I'm of a considered opinion that the kind of changes that are required in order to make our existence somehow more human probably requires some kind of polarization before there can be any significant amount of meaningful change. And so, to some extent, the existence of the women's liberation movement is, in my mind, a terribly positive kind of thing. And I think, to some extent, the men's liberation or the male mystique issue is probably also productive in that it does point out the polarity that frequently precedes meaningful change. Again, as we were talking earlier, I'm convinced that if the end goal of the search for human realization were to be translated specifically into the goals of women's liberation or the goals of men's liberation, that it would be somehow a hollow victory for us to not move beyond the issue of men's liberation or beyond the issue of women's liberation, to somehow or another direct our attention to what it means to live together and survive as a humanity or as a human race, that the victory would be very hollow. And I guess it's for that reason that my own interest in the topic relates less to the issue of masculinity or femininity than to the issue of how I can make myself a more productive human being, and somehow or another disregard, to some extent, role definition, and at the same time be able to, with some honesty, pay attention to role differentiations as being real and viable. And not have to feel guilty about either being a man or to feel guilty about what the women's liberation movement might be saying to me.
Now, Dennis's comment causes me to think of something that I feel very strongly, and that is that there are problems that men must come to grips with, must somehow resolve at a personal and at a group level,
right,
in order to be able to respond to the changing patterns of existence as it involves male and female partners. So I really didn't mean to imply in my earlier comment that there is no problem as far as men are concerned with respect to the equal rights movement or specifically to the women's rights movement. For indeed, I think there are. I think that each of us here tonight have come into contact with those a great many times. There are difficulties, there are problems, and there are very special considerations that need to be made. But as far as those comprising a whole aura or mystique, that leaves me rather cold.
Well, yeah, I think another point with respect to that is the phrase the male mystique is so frequently cast in that angry defensive tone that it establishes the war between the sexes and takes away from any kind of search that either relates to togetherness or relates to something even more abstract than the notion of human realization. And I think that I admit openly that I and all other men have been involved in visiting all kinds of oppression on women. And at the same time, I think it might be worthwhile to explore the fact that in the search for human realization, I as a male have experienced a form of oppression of the same order as have women. It's oppression no matter who it's directed at or who the recipient is. You know, to be told that I somehow or another, to borrow Bill's phrase, have to behave according to the John Wayne image of maleness, or that the only way that you can be male is to have bulging muscles and not to be con-
concerned about things that are maybe more aesthetic or romantic or whatever, is oppressive to me in the realization of my humanity, as the same analogous situation is oppressive to the realization of a woman's humanity.
I would have to agree that the labels of mystique, female and male, is something that comes about, I think, because of lack of communication between the two groups, and it's a major defensive mechanism that comes about, that you go ahead and label the male mystique and the female mystique.
It's curious that men spend so much time talking to women and women spend so much time talking to men, and yet you could point up a lack of communication between them.
Right.
An indication of the quality rather than the quantity.
Well, I think it's communication in a different area, you know. The communication between the male and the female, so it's so restricted as to what they talk about, you know.
What are some of these things then?
I think the main thing that is a problem between the two groups is the main emphasis is on sex, you know, between the relationship between the two groups, you know. And I think that's avoiding a lot of the major issues that revolve around the two sexes.
Well, there are, you know, if we want to get to much more specific about the kind of constraints on our role as men with regard to how we relate to other people, be it men or women, that we are caught in the same kind of role definition that can be considered oppressive as is any woman. The notion that it is all right for women to gather around together in intimate situations and discuss intimate topics meaningfully with each other, and that somehow for men to be seriously involved in and discuss issues of intimacy about themselves, about their relationship, about what they're feeling, about what they're doing, about their plans for life, that somehow or another that becomes interpreted as non-masculine. Again, Bill was talking about this earlier before the program, the sensitivity, and I need to talk about this, Bill, the idea that that as a man there are all kinds of role definitions that say that we should not have certain kinds of relationships with other men, that immediately when a man says that he has a deep and abiding and loving relationship with another man, that he's immediately labeled as a homosexual, or labeled as a fag, or labeled as a weirdo, or labeled as something other than what the typical role image for male would be, and that's a terribly constraining experience, to have to live your life being programmed from some external source that says that having deep and abiding relationships with certain kind of people involves certain kinds of rules, and that you, as a consequence, then can't have a deep and abiding and loving relationship, regardless of the sexual piece, with another male. And I find that very oppressive. And I'm sure that women who are told that they aren't supposed to be involved in athletic events, the women who are told that it is not feminine to do certain things that are significant to their existence, find that equally oppressive and equally detracting from their expression of their humanity.
Sounds to me, in talking here on the show and also talking earlier today, it seems to me that we're kind of crying out, that we're saying that there needs to be men's liberation as much as women's liberation, and that we have to tie this all up together and call it human liberation, that when I, as a man, I'm not allowed to wear my heart on my sleeve, and I can't let somebody else know what my emotions are, because as a male, I'm just not allowed to do that.
Yeah, when it's wrong for me to cry in movies, right, when it's wrong for me to respond to sadness and pain, right?
I think there shows the necessity of a man's awareness, a man's consciousness. Why are we put in a stereotype role where we can't cry in a movie, or when we break up with a girl, you go out and you get drunk to forget about the whole thing, rather than just sitting down and rationalizing what was wrong? The major instinct is just go out and drink it under the table and just forget about things.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking back to when I was first dating the woman who became my wife, and just finding out that women could express emotion so much that I had not seen men express so openly, and that was not terribly eye-opening, but it was a different kind of experience.
Yeah, you mentioned a change in labels from female or women's liberation and men's liberation to human liberation. And something that Alex said triggered a response in me, in terms of, I think what you said, Alex, was why are we locked into these stereotypes, mm-hmm. or put into these stereotypes? I think, like a good many other people, I spent some time being angry
and rather rebellious about some of the stereotypes that I felt locked into. And yet a part of me also wants to say it really doesn't make a bit of difference why I'm into these stereotypes. My reality, or the reality with which, you know, I confront the world each day, says that, yeah, there are some stereotypes that affect me, and some of them are very functional, very useful kinds of stereotypes. Some of them are very oppressive. Some of them are particularly distasteful to me. I think an emphasis that I'm far more comfortable with is, let's just accept the fact that each of us has stereotypic kinds of responses that are patterned into our lives, and I'm very much in favor of providing the kind of situation or climate where people can look at those stereotypic reactions and decide which are functional, which are dysfunctional, and for those that are dysfunctional, which can be changed and in which directions. And I think that's part of the description that I would have to own for myself in terms of why I am involved in, you know, at a minimal level this show tonight, but on a more significant level for my life, why am I involved with the kinds of people that provide and force an environment whereby this kind of change and re-examination and change and re-examination is very much an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the difficulties, of course, when you talk about human realization, that it is almost as abstract and obtuse and to some extent meaningless as are the two other descriptions that we're grappling with as having problems, the male mystique or the female mystique. And I know that for many, many women, and I think some men too, that the changes that one hopes to achieve are the kind of changes that will somehow or another be born out of revolution, out of massive, overwhelming kinds of change that are generally the consequences of a polaris kind of struggle. And yet, I think this is probably the same thing that Bill was addressing, is that for me, the struggle doesn't have anything to do with a revolution. It has to do with the very, very intimate and personal struggle that I become involved in as a human being, to be freed up to use some of the positive stereotypes that define my life, as Bill has suggested, and at the same time to free myself from what are for me some rather obvious constraints on my behavior. That for, as I was telling you earlier, for to decide to type a letter in my office by myself, as opposed to having one of the secretaries do it, sit down at the typewriter and begin my work, and to have my fellow faculty members and secretaries come in and say, you know, with a lot of wise remarks about, gee, look at the new secretary, and isn't she sweet? I find that distasteful, in that it makes not only a comment on me, but all of those who are part of the context in which I work, and that it doesn't allow me to express myself as I would choose to. And there are a lot of, for me, a lot of personal examples of that kind of very personalized struggle. It has absolutely nothing to do with revolution. It has nothing to do with radical movement. It has nothing to do with being a member of men's liberation or being a male member of the Now chapter or whatever. Mm-hmm. That it reduces itself to a very personal and very intimate struggle with defining myself.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that if we're going to achieve anything in talking about this topic of human liberation, the answer is going to have to be forthcoming from individuals, and they're going to have to be working it out with the people that they come in contact with. Any larger answer to this kind of problems that are being suggested is not going to come out of any mass movement or anything like that. But still, we're faced with the reality of women's liberation now, however we want to talk about it. And I see guys coming in, and they're concerned about, where do I fit into this? Mm-hmm. They're concerned because they can see that many women are being sought after for careers. I talk to the people in the School of Business, and I understand that employers come and very much seek out the women, and the men are feeling, well, it's a really tough job market right now. At any rate, men are having to interact with this women's liberation.
I didn't mean by saying that it boils down to a kind of an isolated individual struggle, that the issue of the revolution is somehow or another important, because it is important. I guess I'm saying that, like I said earlier, the polarity is a significant thing. And as a matter of fact, it is, you know, no change happens without conflict. No change that I can think of happens without some kind of conflict in relation to that change. And that it is at that state that we are, I think, presently involved. And yet I think, like most issues of mankind, at some point they reduce themselves to the individual's personal struggle with that issue. And I think what is happening among many men, or at least I'd like to think that it's happening, is that the consequences of the radical women's movement, the positive consequence of that, is that they have been somewhat freed up to begin to think about themselves, who they are, who they want to be, to rule themselves out of certain roles that are constraining on them, to relate in ways that are meaningful for them.
Yeah, I think your emphasis on the personal level is a good one, Dennis, and yet I also see it for myself as kind of a luxury.
It's a slow way to make change.
Sure, I'm male,
yep.
I'm middle class, I'm white. I guess all those things go together to give me some advantages.
Yep.
And until recently, those advantages have been very comfortable, very real, and you bet your life I've worked on them to the best that I could. But your example a minute ago, Walter, of men finding themselves in a job market situation that is competitive from the very outset, but even more competitive now, that a number of qualified women are saying, you know, you will not overlook me and you will not ignore me. That brings it home not only at a personal level for me, but also at a societal level. My privileged status or whatever no longer means a great deal.
Or no longer has the same meaning.
Yeah, it's no longer a privileged status.
Right.
I am faced with a situation where a job market for me would be far more open if I were not white, middle-class male. And that has some very real realities. I spent a good many years preparing myself and gaining experience to do the kind of work that I identified some years ago as being that which I wanted to do, and now I'm finding more and more frequently that some of the doors that would have been very much open to me not only aren't open, but are closed and bolted from the other side. I think that's a reality that I have to confront more at a personal level, but not to the exclusion of realizing that societally it has a base.
Well, I'm thinking of the comment, or Dick's being here suggests a comment to me, the idea that I'm sure on campus there are a number of gals who would be particularly interested in being involved in a variety of competitive athletic endeavors, and yet to express that thing singly to any given coach, to express that thing singly, because it somehow or another bubbles up as a strongly internally felt issue for them, is probably not going to get the kind of changes.
Sure.
But when Dick has 35 gals trundle into his office and say, look, you know, like I'm sick and tired of second-class citizenship with respect to athletics, you have a new ball game. And I think at the same time, my guess is that Dick is very sensitive to how terribly some of those girls feel at being cut out of some piece of activity because its role defined is not appropriate.
Well, I think that my position as a swimming coach really probably would differ from the opinion of a lot of the other coaches, for we grow up in age group swimming where half of our squads are female. Mm-hmm. And until they make the decision that there's something that they'd rather do than pay the price that it takes to become good in the practices and what have you, they're every bit as much a part of the team scoring and the team picture as anybody else. And I think maybe it is their position in a social structure that they would rather do other things than to pay the price really to be good. But I can assure you of this, if you do find one that is not concerned about dating or not as concerned about some of these other things, but is that keeps her interest in athletics, you have really got a tiger. These people and these girls will pay the price that most of your males will not pay. And the ones that make it on the big-time level, say national level, Olympics are up there, they are ever so much as dedicated or more dedicated than their men counterparts. And they're really going after it. And I think that in this day and age, that there a lot of women's athletics is still at a club level as opposed to being an intercollegiate level where they're moving around and seeking more outside competition. But I think it's a coming thing. And I think they're showing that they are competitive, that they do want to get under the competition, that they do want to have a chance to show their skills, and that they want to do it at the level of their abilities as opposed to just having it be with their own classmates at school. And I think funding... How are they going to pay for this is more of a problem now than it is in finding people that are talented and gifted and interested and really could do an excellent job with it.
I think we need to break here for a moment to give the chance for a station break.
You know, anything can happen in a city the size of Lawrence. Some of these things you may like, others you may not, but it all has an effect on you. There's always the possibility that you might not even know about some things that occur in Lawrence that could be of importance or of interest to you. Now, one easy way to find out what's happening in Lawrence and why is to listen to the program City Limits, aired on KANU Friday nights at 7. Bill Redland and Thurk Holland are your men in Lawrence who are there when things take place and decisions are made. They probe what's happening in Lawrence each week to give you a detailed report. Now, whether it's funny or sad, you'll hear about it on City Limits. City Limits, the place to find out about Lawrence and its citizens. We invite you to tune in Friday nights at 7 for City Limits, a presentation of KANU Lawrence, public radio serving you with news about the area in which you live.
You're listening to Jenny's theme from the new motion picture, Young Winston. It's the latest in a continuous series of contributions to the field of popular music from film soundtracks. You can hear much more current and newly released popular music from films on Popular Music in Depth, each Sunday night at 9 here on Public Radio. Besides music from films, you'll hear a wide variety of other vocal and instrumental popular music from record albums, together with information about the artists and the music. I'm John Zimbrick, your host for the program, inviting you to join me each Sunday night at 9 for Popular Music in Depth in Full Fidelity FM Stereo from the University of Kansas, KANU, Lawrence. You're listening to A Feminist Perspective from the Public Radio Service of the University of Kansas, KANU, Lawrence. Here again is Walter Smith.
Okay, remember, our topic this evening on A Feminist Perspective is the male mystique. And discussing this topic, instead of the usual panel of women, are instead four men beside myself, Alex Thomas, Dick Riemann, Bill Robinson, and Dennis Daly. Remember that you're invited to call with your questions on our topic. Our number is 864-4530. Before we go on, let me mention next week's program. The moderator next week will be Jan Sanders, and the topic will be our sexist language. Panelists will be Bonnie Patton, Gene Robinson, and Liz Witt. They'll discuss the nature, manifestations, effects, and means of overcoming our sexist language. And they define our sexist language as any language that expresses stereotyped attitudes and expectations, or that assumes the inherent superiority of one sex over another. So we invite you to tune in next Monday for that. Before we go on, remember, your telephone calls are invited at 864-4530. We're kind of talking about new roles for men. We kind of got rid of the male mystique idea, or tried to anyway. But we still were talking a little bit about men taking on new roles. They're not so concerned about the old idea of heart on their sleeve and so forth. Do we have any evidence that this is happening, that that men indeed are willing to play a new role?
I don't know, talking about from the student point, student level, I find it really hard to believe that there is a change at all as far as the perspective of men. On a system-wide basis, I'd say about 90% of the people in the, for example, the residence hall system, I don't see a change in the attitude. It just hasn't fazed them to the extent of worrying about the new roles, or to put it mildly, they just don't care about what the new role is.
That would seem to suggest that it hadn't affected them to any significant degree, that they've been forced to care.
I think a problem with the question is, how in the devil would you ever get evidence that any kinds of changes have occurred? You tend to relate to people who are very much like you, and I know that among my circle of friends, only I think circumstantially, there is a fair amount of awareness, and among many of those men, some deep and interpersonal kind of struggle. At the same time, you know, I still have to contend with a neighbor down the street who goes into shock when he experiences me doing some things according to my preferences about redefining my role, aside from what women's liberation or men's liberation might have to say about me or for me.
No, talking about the examples of the change, you know, it's obvious, you know, when you're living in a hall where you hear comments where people talk about being proud of being a male chauvinist. You know, I mean, those sitting at the dinner table and hearing people just talk about just one topic, and that's sex. You know, I mean, you begin to see the female in just the role of sex,
of object,
as the object. You know, and that's just a.
We have a telephone call. I understand. Yes, go ahead.
What do the panelists think about game playing? I know that they've mentioned role playing, but what do they think about game playing?
Game playing in what regard, may I ask?
In every respect.
You mean
the most obvious one that comes to my mind is the games that girls tend to play when they're out to, quote, get a husband.
Oh, I love that question. Is there more to the question, or do you want some response now?
Then the other part is, well, game playing is sort of an insensitive thing. Like, there's a lot of roles in it. But then how do they think that sensitivity towards people as individuals with their own wants, needs, desires, and of course they have their problems, how does that concept work in?
Well, I think it'd probably be fair to say that, you know, life is a game-playing experience. I think the issue is the extent to which those games that people play become dehumanizing and, in effect, become somehow or another oppressive. I think, for example, you made an interesting there's an interesting point in your question with regard to the image of women being on campus to play the game of getting a husband. I think there's a great deal within that. It is terribly unfair both to women as a stereotype and to men. To suggest, for example, that it is only men who are here at the university and in the course of that experience may meet somebody who by some kind of agreement they decide they want to spend the rest of their lives with is certainly, I think, not just a concern of women, and in that respect a terribly unfair stereotype of women. At the same time, it's unfair to men to somehow or another see them as being, with respect to finding a mate, as being totally like non-responsive to that or unconcerned about them. Because I think there are many men, you know, like the men that the gals on campus marry are the guys on campus. And I will not accept the perspective that suggests that men enter into marriage or enter into relationships so flippantly as to suggest that they have relatively little caring or little concern about who it is that they're going to spend some period of time in a marital relationship.
General example, I'm sure it works both ways.
Yeah. With respect to your general question as to the impact, I guess, of game playing, first of all, maybe I should say that game playing, per se, is not a negative thing in my mind. In fact, it's not only a very positive thing, it's a very self-affirming kind of thing. I believe that all of us play games at practically every waking moment, perhaps even at some sleeping moments. I would identify game playing as being very consistent and very close to role playing. The games that I play are parts of me, and my primary concern is not with identifying the games or deciding whether they're good or bad games, but deciding, knowing that I am playing a particular game or role or being a particular way because it's something that I need, because it's something that's an extension of my definition of myself, and that in some way or another it is helping to sustain and enhance that self. Is that speaking to the kind of question that you had in mind?
Basically.
I had a couple thoughts that are a reaction to the question, and one is that there's a kind of implication that just suddenly struck me as I was listening to the call tonight, and that is that at least in some respect we're condemning ourselves. We're saying that the men are guilty, kind of like whites are saying whites are guilty and so forth. There's just an implication that we're just laden with guilt, and I think that maybe we should say that this isn't really a question of guilt or lack of guilt. We find ourselves in a particular kind of situation where men's roles are defined one way and women's another way, and we need to work out how we would like to play the roles, so it's not really a guilt question. Another reaction that I had to the question was that in game playing there's something like an implication that men and women aren't honest with each other, and that when they're playing games with each other, they're just speaking words that they think they ought to be saying in a particular situation rather than truly reacting to each other. And I think that if that's what game playing means, that people aren't honest with each other, but rather just mouthing words, then I deplore that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, Walt. I think that games can be very honest. Honest in terms of the person-to-person level, the interpersonal level, and honest in terms of what it's expressing of me at an intrapersonal level. And if honesty perpetuates or characterizes those games, then I'm all for them. I don't see any way to avoid them, frankly.
Okay, then honesty comes around to the point of being sensitive towards other people's needs.
Could you ask the question again? I'm afraid we didn't hear it.
Then being honest with people comes around to the concept of being sensitive towards people as individuals.
I would agree, yeah. Being sensitive to people as individuals as well as being sensitive to self. I think it's a good deal more important that I have some idea as to what's important for me to keep myself together before I make any effort to respond to your needs and what you've decided or I decide you need to keep yourself together.
Yeah, I think a kind of related notion to that, although we may be getting somewhat astray from the question is asked, is the notion that, you know, a great deal of our existence is programmed into us in a variety of ways. And it seems to me that as one continues to grow and as one matures and develops, that the issue is to somehow or another begin to make some interpersonal choices of your own with respect to who you are and what you are, and to somehow or another set aside some of those programming experiences that you've had if they are irrelevant to the way you would like to define yourself. Somewhere along the line, I think, and I think this bears on the game, I think the game playing, that if the game playing is somehow an expression of who you are, and that games are essential to the sustenance of life or to the sustaining of relationships, then those kinds of games surely would be seen as positive, that there's a kind of a gratuitous assumption associated with that, and that is that when you are playing a game, no matter what, that you have some sense of consciousness about it, that you understand both what fed it and what the consequences of it are. And, of course, what that suggests is then a person taking charge of himself, becoming, you know, taking charge of who he is by virtue of what he designs for his life, somehow or another disregarding some of the programming that we've all been subject to.
Yeah. In other words, you're saying that if a person doesn't realize the total aspect of it, they'll cease to play a game and just live the game.
Right, right. I think... you know, if we accept Bill's proposition as a correct one, that is that that game playing is a vital ingredient in life, and that the issue is that all of life is somehow or another game playing. The issue is that some is positive and some is negative. That the only way that one then would be able to resolve that issue is to take charge of that, mm-hmm. to both be sensitive to what gave rise to the game, as well as to be sensitive with regard to the consequences of game playing. And at the same time, to leave within that some room for individual judgment with respect to how you wish to express yourself. So, you know, it's like there's an honest dimension in terms of games and a dishonest intention. I think one of the places where the dishonesty thing arises most easily is when a person shirks his human responsibility to be fully aware of himself and the implications of his kinds of behavior on others. But that's the, you know, it's like out of ignorance that the... that error results, that when you stop being sensitive to yourself and start playing games without that sensitivity, that you increase dramatically the potential that the kind of game playing that you're going to be involved in is going to be destructive to both yourself and someone else.
I noticed that somebody said that law of our values, I think he's saying cultural values are programmed into it. And
that's right.
What ways are they programmed into it besides being raised as a child?
Oh, I think there are all kinds of ways in which we're programmed, certainly not just from the context of family, but we're politically programmed, we're economically programmed, we're programmed with respect to our role as men and as women. If you grew up in the last five decades, you are programmed by certain kinds of theoretical perspectives on man. If you, for example, the ideas of Freud and some of those have programming implications. In other words, we begin to act as we are expected to act. I think the issue is that we are programmed throughout life in a variety of ways. Some of which today, the consequences are that the programming doesn't fit. For example, to be programmed over the last four decades.
with respect to the John Wayne model of, and we are doing, I suppose, an injustice to John Wayne tonight. Okay. But anyhow, to program to express our masculinity a la that kind of model is today it doesn't work. It's not useful. Although I know that there are many men struggling ever so hard, as I am probably struggling on the other end of the dimension, to retain their John Wayne image of masculinity.
I remember an article that was in the Boston Sunday Globe. I don't happen to read that paper regularly. I have the article in front of me, which is talking about men's liberation. And the article concludes by saying, a man to lean on? Well, today women are saying, and sometimes screaming, that they don't want to lean, but to stand straight up on their own feet. The men's liberation says, yes, get off our shoulders, you're too heavy. Stand up, let's look each other in the eye, and maybe we'll see each other clearer. And that has some meaning for me. I frankly resist, perhaps as a rebellious child in terms of transactional analysis, but I really do resist anybody standing on my shoulders that I haven't asked to stand there. And
my belief has been that before all this woman's liberation came along was that girls had a really good thing going, and I can't see how the woman's liberation movement pushed to the extreme that some of these girls are talking about.
No, I think...
I think there was more to his question.
Oh, okay.
You were saying push to the extreme?
Yeah, like becoming as radical in some of the aspects. Like, it seems to me that they're weighing woman's superiority rather than equality.
And that's unsettling to you?
What's unsettling to me is that they have basic biological and physical limitations in it. They're trying to say, to hell with those.
I think the problem with your question with respect to women had a good thing going is that that kind of comment is more than likely shadowed by virtue of its being essentially a masculine opinion or definition of
Absolutely.
What women had going. It's the same kind of paternalistic garbage that is associated with the issue of racism today. A lot of men can't understand women's liberation because they can't understand how women could give up such a good thing given their definition of good thing. And I think the issue is that somewhere along the line men have got to, or women have got to listen to the drum that they hear in their heart, and that men have got to listen to the drum that they hear in their heart, and that we need to at some point stop commenting on each other, stop defining for each other. What turns out to be, I think, a purely negative perspective. I think for a lot of women, the kind of advantages that you or others might see as having a good thing are a mile away from the kind of thing that they would see as a good thing with respect to the expression of their humanity.
Yeah, your comment that until recently women have had a good thing going for them, which is then followed by saying that there are certain physical or anatomical limitations that are biologically present in women, frankly strikes me as being in the same vein as someone telling me that, well, everybody likes fried okra, why don't you? I don't like fried okra because I don't like fried okra, and I decided that for myself. And I think that what I'd be looking for is an opportunity for women and men and small dogs and parakeets to be able to decide whether they've got a good thing going for them or not without someone else setting those limitations or definitions for them.
As a matter of fact, I think it's at least for me, it is out of that essential kind of paternalistic attitude with regarding to describing a good thing, out of which so much of what is today seen as oppression has arisen. It seems to me that that's the seeds of the kind of oppressive societal behavior that at present has resulted in a kind of an explosion in terms of women's liberation. And at the same time, although I'm certain that for many, the radicalized quality of the women's liberation thing is very unsettling, that I still see it as essential to change.
I'd like to change the topic of discussion just a little bit now. I think that we've all given some thought to what it means to be male today and so forth. What about some thoughts about some new role definitions? When we're thinking in utopia kind of things, or maybe not so utopia, a little bit closer to reality, what is the new kind of roles that we would like to see men play, if we're going to pick on John Wayne one more time, if we want to get rid of that image? What is it? Where are we going? And when we interact with other people, how do we Well, particularly I'm thinking that many of us here interact with students who are about to go out and work in companies or whatever. When we talk to them about their new roles, what kind of things are we going to talk with them about?
I don't know whether you've cleared whether we all agree whether it should be a personal level or on a larger level, whether you should keep it to yourself, and when you're asked to, somebody asks for your help, you give them the help, or should we be spreading the word? Is a question that, you know, it's burning my mind, you know, just...
Wait, I'm trying to respond to your question. It's like almost an impossible question. And it would involve a tremendous kind of head job to predict what men's roles, new roles, are going to be, or what women's new roles are going to be. It's like, for me, I find that a non-relevant question. For me, the issue is to somehow or another establish, and I know this is idealistic, to establish some kind of an atmosphere out of which that can grow, and that can be self-defined. And when something more than self is needed for definition, where an individual can feel free to reach out to others for assurance with respect to his definition of himself. Bill, you take a stab at that. You're good at guessing.
Well, I, to some extent, I agree that that's almost a non-relevant question, because it would be, in terms of future impact, it would be just as debilitating now.
It'd be programming.
Yeah, for us to sit here and try to guess at or in some way describe future roles, as that would be as limiting as the roles we find ourselves in now, which perhaps 10 years ago somebody sat down and guessed at. In terms of a way that the new roles can evolve, that's something that I feel that I do have some input into. I feel as though the way that I choose to live or the kinds of things that are important to me very directly help to determine what those future roles might be.
Yeah, I think it's possible to respond to that question if you aim that question right at me, like where I'm living.
Like, where do you want to be in 10 years?
Right, you know, like if you put it right at that level, the answer is terribly relevant to me. You know, like my own personal struggles with respect to this, I can address, but predicting for others, I can't. You know, for me, it's a struggle to feel absolutely comfortable, to be able to respond to my wife's request that I substitute for her at a brownie meeting, and that's filled with brownie leaders and little brownies running all over the place, that I feel absolutely comfortable and in touch with myself as I do that. And I did that, and it was a cherished experience for me, and it did a great deal at a very individual level for me in terms of coming to grips with some of the feelings that I have, some of the ways that I express myself, some of the ways that I unconsciously behave in a way that is obviously chauvinist. And it's these kind of repeated personal experiences that I define for myself and take on for myself that helps me resolve the issue for myself. But predicting at higher levels of generalization at this point are well beyond.
I don't think we can crystal ball here, because anytime we crystal ball, I'm sure our little crystal ball would be broken. But, you know, we are talking about... men can't show concern for each other.
Right.
And it seems to me that implies we'd like to see men show more concern for each other. On the other hand, I suspect that we're concerned with people making a living or whatever it is they're about. And how are we going to make that compatible, making a living compatible with showing concern, when maybe the other person isn't into this thing about showing concern?
And one of the really unjust things that we have done tonight is that we have somehow or another, because of our zeal or because of a game we are playing right now, ruled out the John Wayne stereotype as a non-viable role for man. And in one respect, that is almost as dehumanizing as some of the other kinds of oppressive experiences that we're involved in. It seems to me that somewhere along the line we got to have enough room for a man to express himself in as virile a way as he chooses, and to not have that be seen as negative, and at the same time allow man the freedom to do some of the things that he may decide expresses his humanity. Now, we've done, I suppose, John Wayne a great injustice, or that image a great injustice, because we have kind of a priori closed that out. We've said that's inappropriate, bad.
Yeah, I don't want to say that, because I want to keep that part of me that likes John Wayne just as alive as that part of me that likes Wally Cox.
Absolutely.
And I'm both of those people, depending on what I had for breakfast. But future roles, I guess I am going to forecast a little bit, to the extent that I would like to see the way that I choose to to live or be have an impact on those people that are around me, I'd like to see all of that characterized by as close to total freedom of choice as possible. And I accept fully claims that that is naive and short-sighted,
idealistic
and all of that, but that's fine. If it seems naive, so be it. I still think it's highly desirable.
I think we've just gotten into the topic, at least I feel we've just gotten into it and just begun to talk about what's going on. And I'd like to invite anybody that's listening that wants to get their two cents worth in to come on in and see any of us on the panel. I'm sure that we'd love to continue talking about it because it's not only maybe it would help somebody else get their head together, but I'm sure it would help me.
I agree.
Just by way of announcement, remember that next week the topic is our sexist language, and I'd like to invite you to visit our library. That's you out there, men or women. The library is in the Dean of Women's office in 222 Strong, and there you can find materials on not only the topic we talked about tonight, but almost anything else that would have any relevance to women and how we're trying to work with the problems of women in our society today. And Bill tells me that he has an announcement also that he'd like to make.
Oh, sure, my local plug. The Lawrence chapter of NOW, the National Organization for Women, is about 6 weeks into its formative stages and shows some promise for some exciting kinds of things to come. The next meeting will be at the Trinity Episcopal Church, 10th in Vermont, on Sunday, December 3rd at 7:30 p.m., and we'd be happy to see men and women. Child care is provided free.
Thank you for tuning in tonight to A Feminist Perspective.
Listen again next Monday at 7 for A Feminist Perspective, presented at